2007. Just to preview the agenda, we've got two hearings on House Bill 3313 and 2898, 3313 having been carried over from Friday's or Thursday's agenda, and with apologies to those who waited through that long meeting and then weren't able to be heard. We have four bills set for work session, but it happens that only one of those is ready to work today, which is Senate Bill 270. The House Bill 2125 will be carried over till the Tuesday agenda, and the other two will be postponed until some later meeting will be re-noticed. So I'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3313. Council Calmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3313 establishes that a lien for costs incurred by a county to secure and decontaminate property that has been declared to be a nuisance because of illegal drug activity at the property has priority over all other liens and interests in the property. The bill declares an emergency effective upon passage. There are dash ones and dash twos to this bill. The dash ones extends the priority to liens held by other local governmental bodies, not just counties. And the dash twos I will let the proponents describe because they were handed to me just as I was leaving the office to come to this meeting.
Okay. We have Jim Austin from Clackamas County. Mr. Austin. Oh, that'd be fine.
And may I have Tim Martinez from the
Sure. Yeah. Let's have a whole crew up there.
Okay. Ready? Shall we proceed?
Go ahead.
Fantastic. Thank you. Jim Austin. I'm here representing Clackamas County. I'm here testifying in support of House Bill 3313. In fact, Clackamas County requested that this bill be drafted, so we appreciate the chair and the committee for granting a hearing on this bill. I'll try not to read from my notes directly, but currently there's no reliable method for recouping public funds if they're expended for purposes of cleaning up what had been a clandestine drug lab. I'm sure we're all familiar or know that the chemicals used in the manufacturing of methamphetamines are dangerous. They pose a threat to human health even after the operation has been shut down. These properties are placed on a not fit for use list by the Department of Human Services and can only be taken off that list after they've been cleaned and decontaminated by a licensed certified decontamination contractor. Pardon me. Property owners, private property owners, are ultimately responsible for cleaning up these properties, and local code enforcement enforcement agencies, such as the county's code enforcement division, try to compel voluntary cleanup proceedings, and that's not always the case. They have a very high success rate. For example, in January 2006, there were 15 properties in Clackamas County that were on DHS's not fit for use list. Today, there's only five. Nine of those were cleaned up through voluntary compliance by the property owner. And it's that one remaining property that we're here to talk to you about, which is why we're seeking this priority lien for local governments when they clean up one of these shut down clandestine drug labs, when a property owner doesn't voluntarily take care of it on their own. And in one case, the county had exhausted all efforts to try to compel the owner to initiate decontamination. Our community environment division sought and received a judgment from a hearings officer authorizing the county to proceed with cleanup. So we did that. We subsequently leaned the property to try to recoup those funds that were used in the cleaning up of the property. That lien, however, was tied up in a foreclosure lawsuit, and that lien was not fully satisfied. County Council expended a lot of staff time and was only able to recuperate a portion of those funds. But this example highlights the problems that local governments face when they don't have a, a priority lien or a reasonable method for recouping the funds expended to clean up these drug labs. So this is why we're asking this is why we're seeking for this priority lien. The good news is the proliferation of drug sites and the number of contaminated properties in our communities has dissipated substantially in the recent recent past. House Bill 2485 passed in 2005, which most people or many people may remember as the bill that put pseudoephedrine and other products behind the counters, which are used in the manufacturing of methamphetamines. Since then, the number of properties has decreased substantially. I think in January 2005, there was something in the order of like 300 properties that were on the not fit for use list. Now there's 101 properties. So the number, so that's the good news. We're cleaning up these properties, but there are some that remain. House Bill 2485 also, another provision of 2485 was a provision that placed these not fit for use properties, if they've been on the list for over 180 days, it placed them in nuisance statutes, which made them subject to abatement action by local governments. And statute also, Oregon Chapter 105, also states that the costs associated with cleaning up those nuisances constitute a lien. So in a sense, not that 2485 was modeling what Clackamas County had done, but in a sense it kind of codified what we had already done. We cleaned up the property. We got an order from a hearings officer. We cleaned up a property that a property owner wasn't cleaning up voluntarily. We liened the property. But again, even though we have this now in statute, the fact remains that we still don't have. It's not a priority lien, so it's not really a reliable source for recouping those public funds. So it is here. We are here before you, asking for the establishment of this priority lien, and actually, you know that this was scheduled for Friday, but we weren't able to get to that. The fact of the matter is that time was well spent because I sat down with Ken Sherman, who was the attorney for the Bankers Association. They had some issues with us establishing a priority lien. We spent a very productive morning, talked down in the coffee shop, and then went to legislative council and had Mr. Taylor draft this dash two amendments that are here before you. The dash two amendments, and maybe let's see, there's one element of the dash two amendments that I'll speak to, and those were encapsulated or housed in the dash one amendments. It would include cities. As the bill was drafted, it allowed for counties to have a priority lien in areas that are incorporated. The cities are the code compliance agencies, so the dash one amendments included cities. And I believe that's why Scott is here. And I don't know if Scott, you'd like to speak to the dash one component of the dash two amendments, if that is at all clear.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I don't have a lot to add on top of Jim's testimony other than to commend him for his hard work. In Section 1 of the Dash 2 amendments, it does give this tool to the cities, and while this tool isn't something that we would widely use, it is something we feel is necessary, as one drug house can have a detrimental impact on a larger area, including us in this legislation.
Okay, and to the rest of the dash two amendments, I've got Mr. Tim Martinez from the Oregon Bankers Association, and in a nutshell, how we address their concerns is we give notice to we look on the title and find out who the mortgage company is or the entity that has a note on the property. We provide 60 days. We provide a notice to them and ask them to get back to us within 60 days, so they can perhaps pursue action to take care to remedy the situation on the property themselves. And to that, I guess I'd ask if the committee would allow me to have Mr. Martinez talk to that aspect of the Dash 2 amendments.
Yes, let's hear from Mr. Martinez on the Dash 2s.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm not Kenneth Sherman, Jr., who has prepared the testimony here before you today. I suggested Ken could stay at the office and bill other folks this morning rather than the Oregon Bankers Association, but he'll probably bill twice. He's probably listening as we speak. We did have major concerns, and Ken's testimony does speak for itself. This is an issue that's been around since 1989. We were very much involved in that and setting up the underlying statute. We had some concerns with the way 3313 was drafted. We also had some concerns. Mr. Austin mentioned during his testimony they've had one property that has fallen under this gap, so to speak, since December. So we didn't see this as something that really rose to getting a super priority or a secret lien. But I do believe that the Dash 2 amendments do resolve both our issues and get the counties and other local governments what they want in this legislation. And while Ken has not looked at it, I do believe that it accomplishes the task that we asked Legislative Council to do. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Gentlemen, I need just a little more of a roadmap about what's going on with existing lien law and then how the proposal with the Dash 2 amendments would relate to that. That is, I think I understand that it a tax lien is, even if it arises after, say, a lender's lien on property, is first in priority, so that you have to make sure that the city and county government are paid. Of course, it would be a county function to collect taxes. But that under existing law, that the priority for collecting costs of decontamination would fall after, that is, junior to, say, a lender's lien on the property. And that this, my impression of this bill is that it changes that priority so that a decontamination lien is then senior to a lender's lien. Have I got that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, you do. Tim Martinez again. The 1989 legislation made this lien, it would have priority for anything that was recorded after this lien, but it would be subordinate to any liens, mortgages, or encumbrances that were recorded prior to that date. So that was the compromise that was made in 1989. And from our perspective, that has worked very well for many years. Because our concern in 1989 was to avoid adding another secret super priority lien to Oregon law, and we believe would have created a disincentive for banks and other lenders to lend on low-income housing. 3313 as drafted would have undone that compromise, would have given them not only a super priority lien, but would have made it retroactive, so that if they would have stepped in now at a property like the one he described in December, that would have taken place over a mortgage that could have been written 20 years ago. And that was our concern, that you were now then stepping in front of a mortgage that was made in good faith. And we felt, although Ken doesn't mention his testimony, we felt it was going to cause us real problems on the secondary market. The secondary market loves to know when they buy a mortgage that they are indeed buying a first and are in first place. This would have made that doubtful. Now, obviously very small numbers, but again, we're not sure Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac would have looked at that and said, well, this is only going to happen on a rare basis. So the Dash 2s, what the Dash 2s say, as I understand it, and I defer to Mr. Austin if I get this wrong, is if the counties or other local governments get a property like this, they will notify all the folks that have liens, mortgage liens on the property, and say, what do you want to do about this? And give you a minimum of 60 days to take some action. If the lien holder says, we're going to go ahead and clean it up on our own, then we have a certain period of time to do that, I believe 6 months. We let the county or other local government know we are making progress towards that. And at the end of the time, if we get it cleaned up, then the county then backs out of the picture. If we don't either respond in 60 days or we do respond, don't get it done in 6 months, then the county or other local government has the ability to go ahead and put a lien on this property.
Or in this case, what we'd have to do is we would bid for contract services. We're public agencies, so we have to abide by public purchasing laws. So we would commence to bid for contracts, and then we'd hire a decontamination contractor to take care of it. But we wouldn't do that until either after the 60 days that we've provided, that we noticed that we'd given to the holder of the note.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on what Mr. Martinez just said. After the notice to the lien holders, and the lien holders given the opportunity to clean it up, and you said something about, and if it's not cleaned up, then the county or local jurisdiction can go back to doing that. So then what happens to the lien? If after the 6 months, if the lien holder doesn't clean it up and the county or city does their lien take priority or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, yes, that would become a super priority lien.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger. Mr. Chair, just a second. You mentioned that the 2485 has caused a reduction in meth houses down to zero in December, a couple in January that had to do with cleanup of existing ones. So you're acknowledging probably that this is going to hopefully not be as a prevalent of problems that had been in prior years. What about the existing dump sites that we find as we go forward if they're inside an urban growth boundary but not on developed land? There was property that, who's going to be responsible for those? Is that a landowner? Is he first required by the state to make that cleanup effort? And if he doesn't, then the county and city take over?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger. First and foremost, I mean, it is the responsibility of property owners to clean up these contaminated sites. But the sites that we're talking about right now are only those that have been identified by DHS as not fit for use and put on that not fit for use list. So those are the only ones. And again, we're only talking about the properties that would be subject to this action and this lien are only those that have been on that list for over 180 days and after we've expended efforts to try to compel the property owner to clean them up. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Krieger.
Sure, I think it does to a point, but if the property owner actually owns it, then there may be some lien on it, some mortgage left. Isn't someone eventually going to have to come back on him for those costs, regardless whether you do it or whether the bank does it?
You're
not going to let him walk away with maybe a $30,000 cleanup that was done for him because he didn't do it. Someone's going to be liable.
Chairman Christian, Representative Krieger, I'm not understanding the situation. We're talking about a situation in which the property is owned outright.
Owned outright, or there's a lien on it, and he doesn't clean it up, so you're going to clean it up. So you clean it up because he didn't. Isn't he going to get billed by somebody?
The property owner?
Yeah.
Yes, if our efforts to compel the property owner to clean up the contamination, again, if it's on the not fit for use list and it's resided on that list for 180 days, I wish that I would have had Andrea Hall, who was with me on Friday, who was the county's code compliance specialist. She could have articulated all the efforts, and she's the person who does the notice and engages property owners in trying to compel them to clean them up. But Chairman McPherson, Representative Krieger, yes, I guess that we would, you know, if it's a property that wasn't cleaned up and after we've expended our efforts to try to get the property owner to voluntarily clean them up, we would contract with a decontamination contractor and then put a lien on the property, which would be the responsibility of the property owner to cover.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Austin, in Section 1 of the Dash 2, beginning of that, we talk about the nuisance described in ORS. Are there other nuisance besides illegal drug manufacturers listed in ORS 105.555?
Yes, Chair McPherson, Representative Wisniak. There are other nuisances that are listed, and we are not seeking a priority lien for those nuisances. We feel that because of the level of risk to public safety, to health and public safety, and the environmental concerns that arise from contaminated former manufacturers, methamphetamine manufacturing sites, these merit being cleaned up. And that it's for that reason that
Chair followed. Mr. Ron, thank you, Chair. Well, then, reading this, you know, we just got it ourselves this morning. It appears then that you're moving all those nuisances to the front of the line, not just the illegal labs.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I apologize. That was not the intention of the bill that we brought forth. And again, I'm actually surprised that the Dash 2 amendments that are before us today are actually here. We had just sat down and talked with Mr. Taylor and Legislative Council on Friday, and I wasn't aware that these were to be ready. I thought perhaps that we would just only have to be in a position of speaking to them in concept, and so I've actually not had a chance to sort of fully read through this, but Representative Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, it was not our intention to put all of those nuisances subject to priority lien.
For the benefit of the committee and the witnesses, we won't be
working
the bill today because the amendments are so fresh, so we'll give an opportunity for members of the committee and for the interested parties to take a look at this language and make sure that it reflects what was discussed when you were meeting last week.
Thank you, Representative Chair McPherson. Yes, I assure you that if we were looking to establish a priority lien for every nuisance listed in 105, that we would probably have larger issues with the Bankers Association than we were able to resolve with the Dash 2 amendments. So.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which one of you can answer this question. Obviously, these are all new. But on page three of the Dash 2 amendments, line 11 through 15, that section in there, it refers to the section are not paid within the time established in an order issued by the governing body. So this is when we've gotten into, the way I read this bill, this is when we've gotten into the point where all the lien holders have been notified, the property owner's been notified, and the place hasn't been cleaned up, the government's involved, cleans it up, and now has the superior lien on that particular property. Who establishes that time frame? And I'm just curious as to, because now the governing body can proceed with foreclosure. So how is that time frame established?
How did we establish, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, how did we establish the 60-day notice timeline? Or
no, I'm referring to if the cost described in subsection 3. Is that referring to if the cost described in subsection 3 of this are not paid within an established, within a time established, is that what that's referring to?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm looking at page 2 and I'm trying to find your language. I apologize. Can you?
Okay, maybe. Well, I guess it says page 3, but it's there's only 2 pages to the amendment. No, I guess
these are the costs they're talking about right here.
Okay.
In section 3.
Okay, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm on page 3 of the Dash 2 amendments, and I'm looking at line 13. I think I'm there now. The cost described in section 3.
Okay, just so I understand, maybe I'm just a little bit confused. So that's referring to the cost the government incurred to secure and decontaminate or certify because the lien holder and the property owner didn't do it. And maybe the language in there has just got me a little bit confused. So basically, I have an opportunity to pay that within, in other words, you're going to send me another letter saying we've done this and you have 60 days to pay it, otherwise we're going to file this lien on your property. Is that what that is? Or is it actually going to foreclose on the property and force me to sell it?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. Yes, I'm looking at this now, and yes, the costs that are described in Section 3 of this section, not paid within an established, within the time established. As 3313 is written currently, and as the Dash 2 amendments would allow for, if we were to contract for services to clean up property after we've tried to compel the property owner to do it, and we've received an order that it's okay for us to do so, this is lines 11 through 15 on the dash 2s on page 3. That's language that LC put in. I'm guessing I'm thinking what they were looking to get at is, yes, to provide an opportunity. If we've contracted, somebody could conceivably come in and pay for that before we would file a lien and file it with the county clerk, which would be fine for us. But I think that is what that is getting at. But as to the time established under 3313, as we've requested, we would be able to file the lien immediately. But if someone came forward, as we were getting ready to file the lien, and wanted to pay for it, be it the property owner or the mortgage holder, I don't know that we would begrudge them that. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Cameron.
Let me just follow up. So what is the statement, and maybe somebody can help me understand this, shall cause the lien to be foreclosed as provided in ORS Chapter 88? What does that mean? Mr. Martinez, can you? I see you shaking your head over there a couple times.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I'll take a shot at it, but maybe counsel can help as well. As I read lines 11 through 15 in the dash 3s and go back and look at sub 3. Sub 3 says that, if you step up, if the county or local government steps up and does it, then you go ahead under this section and go ahead and file your lien. After your lien is filed, if you're now trying to get the landowner to pay that off and they don't pay it within a timeline, which I don't think has been established either in this bill or in general statute. Maybe Mr. Austin knows that. But if you don't meet that timeline, then the county or other local jurisdiction can come in and foreclose. And to collect those costs. Okay. So I think it's fairly straightforward on what the counties and other local governments are going to be able to do, but I don't know what the time frame is, and I don't know if council has that or if Mr. Austin knows that as well.
Chairman McPherson and committee and Representative Cameron, I don't know what that timeline either. Either as when I was sat down with Mr. Sherman on Friday, and we talked about what would satisfy the concerns of the Bankers Association, we had talked about a timeline of providing a 60-day notice to a mortgage holder for them to get back to us and indicate whether or not they were going to initiate action or whether or not they were going to contact the property owner. And then we talked about providing that institution with a six-month window to clean up the property, or I'm guessing that would be a foreclosable action, in which, I don't know if they would want that person to be in that property and have that property either. But with regards to this language making reference to a timeline, that would be a question that I guess I would have to defer to Mr. Taylor, the drafter of this amendment. I don't know what timeline that is referring to.
Well, here's what I recommend, committee and witnesses. I think that because these are so fresh, these amendments, and counsel to the committee hasn't had a chance to really go through them, and we have a source that we can go to, and the counsel for the Bankers Association, Kenneth Sherman, who's not here today. So I think there's an offline discussion that could be productively had about the particular language here. So we had to focus ourselves on the policy choices that are reflected here, and as I understand it, the policy choice is to allow this superior lien to arise, but only after prior lien holders are put on notice and are given an opportunity to take curative action themselves. So that's basically the solution that's been crafted here, and it sounds like a good solution to me. And I'd say focus on that, committee. And there are further questions from the committee to this panel that would be useful to develop it, we could put them to them, but otherwise, we'll probably take this thing offline.
I just have One question, Mr. Chair, and that has to do with the 6 months, because apparently from the time of the determination that there's a problem and you give the notice to the lien holders, and then there's 60 days to respond, but I can't find the 6 months anywhere, and I'd want to make sure that there's enough time for the work to be done, and I'm assuming that the 6 months starts running after the 60 days and doesn't incorporate the 60 days. So I just want to make sure that that's clarified in whatever comes back to us. Thank you.
Okay. And just so we understand what the intent was, regardless of whether it's reflected in the amendment, is it this, if I was tracking earlier accurately, the 60 days is a period within which the prior lien holders can respond to say, no, we want to take action. And if those 60 days go by and they don't respond, then the county or city can go ahead and contract the work to be done and get a superior lien. But if within the 60 days the prior lien holders say no, let us take care of it, then that starts the running of a 6 month clock within which they can get that work done. Have I followed that right?
Chair McPherson, yes, that is correct, and that was the intent of our requesting of the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay, I think we're settled on that. Any other questions? Then thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one other witness signed up, Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we have not yet taken a position on House Bill 3313, but it's very consistent with some principles upon which we operate, and I expect that we will, and it will be in support both of the bill original and also of the Dash 2 amendments. With regard to a question raised by Representative Bonamici, I think the 180-day provision is contained in another statute, which says that if after 180 days the problem has not been cured, the property becomes a public nuisance. And as a public nuisance, that triggers the authority and the duty of the local government to clean up the property.
Very good. If there are no questions, then thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will now close the public hearing on House Bill 3313 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2898. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2898 creates Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Board, Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Advisory Committee, and Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Fund. House Bill 2878 creates Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Board, the board, consisting of 11 members, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards or Training, or the Director's Designee, 2 members recommended by the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, 2 members recommended by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, a district attorney recommended by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, 2 members of the automobile insurance industry, 2 members of the general public, 1 member of the Oregon State Police. Terms of office are for 4 years, and members may be reappointed. There's no compensation for members, but there may be some travel allowances. The board meets at least once every 6 months. Its purpose, in sum, is to study, develop, and implement a plan to address the problem of motor vehicle theft throughout the state. It has the authority to make grants from the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Fund to public agencies. The fund grows from the imposition of a semi-annual fee on each insurer that issues comprehensive vehicle insurance in Oregon. The fee amount is 50 cents per vehicle that has comprehensive vehicle insurance. The fund may also grow from gifts, grants, or donations. House Bill 2878 also creates the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Advisory Committee, which consists of the governor's designee, 3 state senators appointed by the Senate president, they all cannot be from the same party, 3 state representatives appointed by the Speaker of the House, same rule as to bipartisanship, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or the director's designee. The purpose of a committee is to advise the board on the effectiveness of its programs and then also to look for additional funding sources.
Thank you, Council. We have a number of names signed up for the proponents of the bill. I have 6 names here. Dan Fennell, Lieutenant Bob Stay, Bob Gross, Detective Scott Thomas, Officer Tim Holmes, and Sergeant John Shaver. And so I'll let you decide in what what groups you want to bring up, but I suggest since we don't have probably enough space for everybody, why don't we bring three and then three and let you decide among yourselves who should come in what order.
That it would fall into any money like the insurance from the general fund.
Well, I was here when it said 7 o'clock. Nobody else was.
I said there was a problem. I'm going to work on it.
You can go in whatever order among those three you wish, but do start out by identifying yourself for the record.
I think we'll start with the attorney.
Lucky me. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Dan Tinnell. I'm the chair this year of the RESIC Legislative Committee, who has drafted and is sponsoring this bill. I'm not going to talk very long because I'm going to let the experts in law enforcement discuss with you the problems of vehicle theft and the ties from vehicle theft into other crimes in this state. But by way of introduction, I'm an attorney in private practice, and once going into private practice, I was recruited by RESIC because I was a deputy district attorney in Washington County for 6 years. We have a number of pieces of legislation this session that deal with economic crimes, particularly identity theft, and I think what you will hear in the next little bit from our witnesses is the tie with vehicle theft into identity theft. I also want, just because I know from discussions beforehand, there's some concerns from at least two entities regarding the funding proposals for how the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Board will be funded. I've had conversations with both of those groups and will stand by for questions directed at those issues. But other than that, I'll turn it over to the experts.
Thank you, Mr. Trail.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee members. My name is Bob Stye. My address is 100 High Street, Northeast Salem. I am a lieutenant with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and today I'm here on behalf of Sheriff Raul Ramirez, who serves on the recent board. For information, if you're not aware, according to the FBI crime statistics, Oregon ranked 33rd nationally in 2001. On a number of stolen vehicles. However, has moved to number 9 in 2004. Lane County, for example, has experienced 125% increase in motor vehicle thefts between the year 2000 and 2005. And I think this story is pretty comparable to just throughout Oregon. What I'd like to do is just make you aware, once again, if you're not aware, just of the direct relationship between motor vehicle thefts and thefts that are related to motor vehicles, methamphetamine addiction, and the problem we have with identity theft and other fraud-related crimes as a result of somebody getting a hold of your personal identification. We have seen vehicle theft in the law enforcement community as kind of being what we would describe as a gateway crime that is connected to methamphetamine activity and identity thefts throughout the state. We have seen the use of stolen vehicles to be used as portable labs, meth labs, as well as being utilized to steal mail, particularly from our rural areas, and of course the mail being stolen for the purpose of retaining personal identification to commit fraud-related types of crimes. And we know that in the law enforcement community that auto theft is a preventable crime. Unfortunately, at this point, we don't have the resources to have a comprehensive plan to combat auto theft, and we think through the support of this particular bill that this would be a tool, once again, that law enforcement can utilize, working not just with law enforcement, we're working with our communities, working with the insurance industry, and others to develop a plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Stye.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Gross, and I'm a retired Portland police officer. I spent 30 years working the streets of Portland. I'm currently the law enforcement liaison for LOJAC here in Oregon. LOJAC is a stolen vehicle recovery system. I'm here to kind of just tell you about Auto Theft Task Force and what kind of an impact they have on auto theft. In 1995, I was asked by Chief Charles Moose to put together an auto theft task force. It was to be a multi-agency task force. At that time, in 1995, Portland was ranked number 3 per capita in the United States for auto theft. It was just going over the, it was going out the roof. We needed to do something about it. So I was tasked, along with Lieutenant Jerry Nyberg of the Portland Police, to put together this task force. We did so, we trained our officers, and we hit the street. This task force was comprised of approximately 14 members of the Portland Police. We had two Clackamas County deputies, two OSP troopers, and we had a Multnomah County deputy district attorney. Since no one had been aggressively working auto theft, this was new for the bad guys when we started hitting the streets. And in the first 3 years, we reduced auto theft by 51%. This was only supposed to be a one-year trial program, and it was limited funding. So we had to pretty much put this unit together with bubble gum and rubber bands and whatever else we could come up with to keep the officers on the street. But we were so successful in dealing with the criminal element that was stealing cars that they allowed us to continue on. But as all things go, the budgetary needs of the department overweighed the task force, and after about three and a half to four years, we lost our OSP troopers, and we also lost our Clackamas County deputies. Shortly thereafter, within about, I believe it was in 2000 or 2002, I can't remember the dates. I've been retired now for 5 years, so it's getting a little foggy. But we lost half of the auto theft task force, which Portland provided, because they needed those officers in other areas, simply because of budget restraints. The auto theft task force, which I believe was the only auto theft task force that has been working in Oregon for the past 10 years, was disbanded last year. I believe it was in December. Now there is no one in the state currently working auto theft. Those reductions in auto theft are now starting to creep back up again, and it's as a result of nobody aggressively working it, and that takes dollars. And I might also add on what Lieutenant from the Marion County Sheriff's Office, he basically talked about methamphetamine and identity theft, and I can concur and confirm that just about every Roland stolen that we stopped, and we stopped a bunch of them, that was what we were dealing with, was identity theft, stolen mail, credit card fraud, methamphetamine, burglary, and any other piece of theft you want to talk about, it's related to auto theft. Auto theft is not just auto theft. It's everything else that goes along with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Any questions for this panel?
Representative Barker. Thank you. Good to see you again, Bob. It seems to me one of the problems is there's not that much of a sanction for auto theft. I know my daughter was a victim of that, and he was supposed to go to prison but didn't go to prison, and then he was supposed to pay money. He won't pay the money. He won't pay restitution. The parole officer won't violate him, won't send him to jail. And I remember when Penny Harrington was chief in Portland, she was going to do away with the auto theft detail altogether. I was a sergeant in auto theft at the time, because she said there's no penalty, so why are we wasting our time arresting people? But, I mean, it's a huge financial loss if you're the victim of that and somebody messes your car up. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of rambling here, but kind of a question. What are we going to do to really, I mean, you arrested a lot of people. You did an excellent job there. And then what happens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker. Hi, Jeff. When we first started, the DA's office was very proactive. We got some legislation passed, I believe, in either 96 or 97, which was kind of like a three-strikes law. And if you got arrested for auto theft more than once or twice, and I believe if you were a multi-offense type person, there was a mandatory one-year sentence either in the county jail or the state prison. Now, I don't know what's happened since then, but when that came into effect, that's when our auto theft rates started to really go down. And I believe there'll be testimony here from Salem PD. They had a similar reduction in the last couple of years because they were taking their prolific car thieves off the street. You charge them with everything you can. And we're talking not just auto theft, but most of the time, like I said, when you stop a car, you're going to have stolen mail. You're going to have fruits of the crime from other crimes like burglary or thefts or shoplifting or credit card fraud. So you dime them up. I mean, you charge them with everything. And then it's up to the DA's office to keep those charges in force when this person goes to trial so that you try to take the offender off the street for a year to 18 months. And that's how you reduce auto theft. I know Salem was very successful. We were very successful. But I'm not sure how the laws are now and whether we have room at the end as far as beds at the county jails and the state prison.
Okay, thank you.
Chair McPherson and Representative Barker and other community members, just an example in Marion County, one of the things that, because the sheriff has the jail, so to speak, we have our jail capacity here in Marion County is 528, plus we have a work release center, which is I think the maximum is about 144 beds there. And one of the things that we have done, trying to utilize the tools that we currently have and to support law enforcement on the streets bringing in the property crime individuals, is actually dedicate jail space to those people. You know, there is a cost to be paid on that because you've got to let somebody out the back door. We call it we let people out the back door about 6 o'clock in the morning. But we did have dedicated jail space just because it is so important for us to address this and keep these people off the street so they at least have an opportunity to get into some type of, first the accountability, then hopefully some type of treatment, especially for a meth-related addiction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gross, I'm interested in the technology aspects of this. I know low jets are supposed to be very effective, but frankly, they're pretty expensive, I think, for the average consumer, at least at this point in time. And I'm not sure if one's insurance rates go down with that product. But are there other, perhaps, developments in that area that might help from a technological point of view of addressing the issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, is that correct?
That's exactly okay. Right.
LoJack, like I said, is one of the levels of protecting your vehicle from motor vehicle theft. And it's pretty much after the vehicle's been stolen is what LoJack is. LoJack is, I guess you could call it expensive if you've got a used car and you're installing it on a used car. LoJack is basically radio frequency technology. It's a transceiver that is hidden inside the vehicle. It's about the size of a cell phone. It's $695 at a dealership when it's purchased. If it's on a new vehicle, you can roll it into your payments, and I think it's about $20 a month. But it's cheap protection if you want to get your vehicle back in under 24 hours. Usually we get the car back within about 2 to 4 hours. That's the average right now in an area where we have a lot of trackers, and that's Portland, Vancouver, Multnomah County, Clackamas County. Right now we've got coverage in Marion County, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, Washington County. But it's just one of the steps in that. And law enforcement has the trackers to recover the vehicles in their vehicles. That's what my job is to get law enforcement up to speed. And we donate, LoJack does, all of the tracking equipment. It's about $2,000 per patrol car, which is donated to the PD so that law enforcement using LoJack's equipment can get the stolen vehicle back in a timely manner. The average recovery time that when I was seeing in auto theft task force could range from 7 to 14 days. And if it was a professional thief who targeted your car for parts or out-of-state transport, you never saw your car again, at least not in one piece. So getting your car back in less than 24 hours with very, very little damage is a plus as far as I'm concerned. And I wish we'd had LoJack when I was working ATTF at the time. But that's kind of the Reader's Digest version on what LoJack can do for it's kind of like mini bait cars, if you look at it that way. The more people that have them, the greater chances are that police are going to catch suspects who steal those cars.
Follow-up? I was actually considering purchasing one recently and was told that the people who are stealing cars now know about LoJack, and so they'll drive the car a few blocks, leave it for a few, and go across the street and watch it for a certain period of time, and if somebody shows up, they know that there's a LoJack, and if nobody shows up, they know that there isn't a LoJack, and then they continue on with the car. So it sounds like it's pretty effective. It's just a cost issue, I think, for most people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici. Yeah, that's true. In fact, Seattle, King County, that's what they're finding quite often now. But what we're doing is LoJack is getting your car back in a very timely manner, and most of the time there's going to be very little damage to it. You might have an ignition damaged or maybe a door lock, but that's the purpose of it, is to get your car back and with as little inconvenience as possible and as little damage as possible, rather than the 7 days or the 14 days or the car coming back non-operable or in parts, and that's the beauty of the system.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know how many cars are insured comprehensively in the state of Oregon? Does anybody know?
No, I don't.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm sure that the members of the insurance industry that are here or possibly the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs could answer that question. When I had a conversation with three policy people from Department of Consumer and Business Affairs on Friday afternoon, who apprised me of their concern regarding what they view as a retaliatory tax concern. I know they've briefed Representative Barker on that issue, at least that's what they told me in my phone call. They threw out the figure that there were approximately 2 million comprehensive policies in the state of Oregon, and I would not take that figure to the bank, but that's the figure that we were discussing on Friday.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may?
Go ahead.
Do we know how many registered vehicles there are in the state of Oregon?
I don't. But I know it's the figure is higher than the number of comprehensive policies.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, if I may, I see consumer business affairs involved in this. I don't see the DMV involved in this anywhere. And I'm just curious how some of these grants by this board would be. Can you describe how these grants, we're talking, if there's $2 million or 2 million vehicles, the way the bill's lined out, that's $1 million a year. Can you tell me where that $1 million a year is going to go and describe for me what it would look like in the state of Oregon?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, how we foresee the money being used obviously would be decided upon by the board, but bodies in law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, equipment, bait cars. I know that currently Detective Sergeant Shaver from the Washington County Sheriff's Office, who you'll hear from in a moment, can discuss with you the insurance industry donating bait cars that are placed in high-frequency auto theft regions and then tracked once they're stolen. A few examples of that have been on the news lately, but it would be used to increase the equipment and the bodies that are out there fighting auto theft, which in discussing the creation of this bill, there's been an acknowledgement that those a lot of times those property crimes units are the first to go when there's budget problems, and this could help replace some of that, replace those bodies and that equipment to continue to combat this on a statewide basis. I think you'll hear in some of the testimony coming up, for instance, when Portland had an auto theft task force, the numbers of auto thefts in Portland would drop, but you would see a corresponding increase in other state counties in the state. In fact, there's some graphics in a packet that we will hand out that shows that figure. And if you can't really fight something like this on a one county or one city basis, and that's why we believe in a statewide targeted approach, that board can spend the money where they think it's best used.
Thank you. So there's a potential these grants could be used. For example, Marion County that says I'm going to dedicate so many jail beds to car theft that there might be a grant for jails?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I believe that the legislation as drafted has no restrictions on how the money could be used, and if the board believed that they should fund 10 jail beds in Marion County for a period of a year or two to help combat a spike in this, we believe that the legislation is drafted, so if the board believed that was a good use of the money, they could do so.
Okay. One last question, if I may. There's a dual committee or board or whatever here. There's a board of the law enforcement DAs, and then there's a board of, I think, legislators. Why are we keeping them separate in this model?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I'm going to kind of swing blind on this one, but try to answer the question. This bill was modeled on similar legislation from Arizona and Colorado, who also have auto theft prevention authorities. And in looking at the statute, we never discussed the particular reasons for that, but to me it seems pretty obvious that one is the applied board, and then there's an advisory board that works on funding and how this is impacting insurance in Oregon. I believe when we were having our legislative meetings about this issue, there was a corresponding, for instance, in Arizona, one of the figures was with the Auto Theft Prevention Authority, for every dollar that was spent, $10 was returned in restitution from the increased prosecutions in auto theft. I don't have the source of those figures, but they would work together, one, to apply the money and decide on the priorities, and the other would be more of a policy advisory committee.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that if you're a victim of this type of crime, then you figure out how serious it can be. And I think if you think back, we've actually had some cars stolen when there were children asleep in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And then it could lead to something far more worse. I was thinking back, having read some Western novels recently, they used to hang them when they stole your horse. How many of those would you hang before you had a real drop in car theft? And then you could go on to say, I don't think that's radical myself, but we have a sheriff, I think it was in Arizona, that had the work camp out in the middle of the desert, and that's where he put those type of people, and it's not going to cost you $25,000 a year. You feed them two meals a day, they don't need three, they're not doing nothing. I'd set them out there in the middle of the desert and put some wire around them, and you can do it for about $6,000 or $7,000 a year.
You may have a future after your legislative services stuff.
I would love to do that for a few years. You'd see a lot of curing taking place. Not much recidivism.
If there are no further questions, we'll excuse this panel and invite up Detective Scott Thomas, Officer Tim Holmes, and Sergeant John Shaver.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Shaver, and I'm a detective sergeant with Washington County Sheriff's Office, where I've been employed for 15 years. Currently, my assignment is to supervise a team of detectives that work property crimes, primarily that being burglary and auto theft. Within Washington County, we have well over 1,000 stolen cars every year. Some cars are simply stolen for a crook to have transportation from point A to point B, but oftentimes we find they're used to facilitate other crimes. They may not have their own car, but even if they do, they certainly don't want to be seen in it while they're committing a robbery, burglary, stealing mail, or passing a fraudulent check. Each stolen vehicle can result in the generation of numerous police incidents. Obviously, you have the initial investigation. You may have arrests, recovery. We may send out a forensics team or crime scene tech after the fact. The result is that this can quickly become a drain on resources for police agencies. Just within the first 30 days of March of this year, and March only, and just within Washington County, there was 249 dispatch incidents related to stolen vehicles. Again, just within 30 days within Washington County. I found an interesting tidbit that was in a December 2004 report from the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis that stated that auto theft is the most common offense committed by repeat property crime offenders, and there's no doubt in my mind that that's true. And as was mentioned earlier, past legislation has provided for minimum sentencing provisions for repeat car thieves, and we thank you for that. But if we can't catch them, it's a moot point. If we don't have the resources to go find them, it's a moot point that we can lock them up for minimum sentences. Of the agencies within Washington County, the Sheriff's Office has by far the largest team of detectives that work property crimes. But that being said, we're completely inadequate in our efforts to investigate, prosecute, and prevent auto theft. Many of the cars that we do recover are damaged, stripped, or burned. Many are also never recovered because they're chopped, parted out, exported, or re-tagged and sold to an unknowing victim. And thieves in Washington County are also targeting specific high-dollar car parts. Particularly, we have a crew right now that are stealing airbags and seat belts from cars. They'll go to your car in your driveway, cut a hole in the hood, cut the battery cables, disable your alarm, and cleanly remove the airbags and seat belts. We have no idea who's doing this. Obviously, it's a well-organized group because they're doing professional removals of these parts, and they have to have a way of getting those high-value parts back into the marketplace to be reinstalled on vehicles. That's just one component of many types of car parts that are targeted in addition to cars. We know that, as been testified earlier, that the cars themselves are a nexus for crime. If we stop a rolling stolen, we know that we're also going to find evidence of burglary or a drug deal that just occurred or a fraud, a pile of stolen mail. It makes sense to us that if we could adequately enforce vehicle theft, that at the same time we'd be having a great impact on other crimes such as burglary and ID theft. And I could probably count on one time, or on one hand, the times that I've been involved in a stolen vehicle where there wasn't a nexus to methamphetamine in particular. The two are just absolutely hand in hand. Mr. Tunnell mentioned earlier about bait cars, and we have had some success with using bait cars, which are donated to us by insurance companies, in catching people as they're breaking into cars to either take parts or steal them. But that's the tip of the iceberg, and this can't be done from agency to agency. We need to have a statewide approach on this to be effective. We have another case currently where a family was on vacation at the coast. A couple of methamphetamine abusers stole their car from out in front of their hotel, saw their vehicle registration in the glove box, knew the family wasn't going to be home, drove to their Bull Mountain home, burglarized their house, loaded both of their vehicles with their stolen property, and removed that property to the Gresham area. So here you have a series of crime scenes spread around the state, and there's no way that one agency or one funding government can adequately address that. And I know that Officer Holm has some great experience with bait cars as well. I imagine he'll address that. That's all I have for you.
Okay. Let's hear from Officer, well, whichever order you wish to, yeah, those two gentlemen.
Yeah. No, actually, in 2005, Salem established a bait car program with donated cars from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
Excuse me, Officer, if you could, for the record, identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tim Holm. I'm with Salem Police Department. When we implemented this program, the great significance was we were able to identify our prolific car thieves. And from basically 2004 and 2005, we were able to, with identifying our car thieves, our prolific ones, we're also identifying people who are also part of identity theft and meth users. And with talking with the district attorney's office, we were able to, I guess, selectively target certain individuals who were high profile and able to get them significant jail time for 2006. Since I've left the auto theft, and returned to patrol, the new detective in my position is now setting, I don't have the exact figures for the first quarter of this year, but he's put it in the words that it's exploded since what we've seen in 2005. And actually, we had a decrease in 2006 by 26%. We went from about 1,000 cars being stolen down to 781 in 2006. We kind of looked at that. People were asking why, and it was a focus. We focused on individuals who were prolific. We were able to talk with the district attorney, who was able to get on board and say, yes, we can combine an auto theft, either a property or a drug offense. All of them are, we find evidence of methamphetamine use, and the identity theft. All these people, they don't have their own vehicles. They're using stolen vehicles to get from point A to point B. We find them carrying their profiles, their identity profiles with them. They're carrying computers with them. They're carrying printers with them. We find them with check stock. And they're all in these vehicles, and they're moving about in the middle of the night, and patrol is stopping these cars. And as the sergeant was saying, these are gateway. These lead to other things. I get calls in the middle of the night and we're spawned out. We either go to a local motel, depending on the cooperation of the driver at the time. We would then either go to a location, whether we get consent or I'd write a search warrant, we'd get inside, and sure enough, we find, like I say, evidence of burglaries. We find additional profiles. And these people are somewhat knowledgeable that they know that if a profile or identity that they have and accounts that they are working, they know they can use them quickly, and they're using cars because they don't have them. They're stealing cars, whichever available, and going from point A to point B as quickly as they can to, do their identity theft, to buy their methamphetamine, or try to pawn other stolen equipment or stolen items. We have had good success with our bait cars. The systems that we're using, part of the board or the committee that would be formed, would be able to, a goal would be to establish a fleet of cars with the same technology that could be loaned out to individual agencies. And when they identify they have a problem area, we can implement a car into that area, and we can either try to identify a prolific offender and, catch them in the act while they're actually stealing a car. I see we'll probably start seeing another increase just because in 2005 the jail time that we were able to get for some of the offenders and the beds that were set aside, these people are now, their sentences are up. They're anywhere from 13, 18 to 26 months. I think the largest quantity of time I got was for an offender who was responsible for 25 cars, and he got just over 5 years. So we're talking 60 months for 25 cars, and it was arranged around a plea agreement. Other than that, I really turn it over to Detective Thompson.
Sir, my name is Scott Thomas. I'm a detective with Eugene Police, and I'm here on behalf of my chief, Bob Lehner, recently from Arizona, where they do have an auto theft prevention authority. He wanted me to express his and the city of Eugene's support for this system. It's going to sound like a broken record,
but I'm going to say the same things. Car thieves don't just steal cars. They do burglaries. They do identity thefts. They use meth. I think that's kind of obvious to everyone here that's heard a little bit about this. The authority gives us several things that we don't already have, one of which is some training for officers, for DMV personnel. We see a number of problems when vehicles come through DMV. There was mention of cars that have been re-tagged. And that's where somebody takes the identity from a legitimate vehicle, puts that on a stolen vehicle, and then sells it. Unfortunately, DMV now provides no training for its staff, and they're the ones who inspect these vehicles that are coming in from out of state. You get a clerk that comes out, the serial number on the dash matches the paperwork, they sign it off, and we have us a new victim, somebody who's just paid $20,000 in cash for a vehicle that is actually a stolen. And then we as law enforcement have to go recover that, and it creates a lot of problems with our folks when we have to take away something like that. And this training would help reduce some of that. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for their new curriculum has done away with auto theft training. There's actually organizations such as the Western States Auto Theft Investigators, which is a group that helps try to provide some training for officers. But that's something we're hoping that the authority would be able to step up with, is to get some good quality training for the officers so they know how to spot stolen vehicles and they know the theft techniques that are being used and how to prevent that, because that's what we're talking about, is being able to prevent these things from being stolen as well as recover them and prosecute them afterwards. But that prevention up front saves a lot of trouble on the back end. I'd also like to add my two cents to some of the stuff that's been mentioned before. There's a packet that I don't know that you have it yet, but there is a graph that shows Portland police and the effectiveness of the auto theft task force, and a projection for what auto theft would have been like had there not been a task force. And when you look at that, what I'd like you to do is to think about the city of Eugene, because that's who I'm here to talk for today, who in 1993, we had less than 400 cars reported stolen to the city. But in 2005, 12 years later, we had over 1,700. It went up 400% in that dozen years. And if you look at the graph from Portland, you'll see that that's exactly what that projection is. So when I looked at that and first was skeptical, I saw that it exactly matched what we have experienced. We didn't have a task force. We've had pretty much everything else in place, that, such as the minimum mandatory sentences for property offenders. But without that task force, we saw the numbers that are projected in that chart. So, I wanted to express support for that as being reasonable from my experience at Eugene. I've been working auto theft for 10 years. 8 of that has been specifically to auto theft. But since we've become so inundated, we've now taken our 5 property crimes detectives and 2 auto theft, and we've turned this all into auto theft along with the other property crimes. Because, as was mentioned before, when we work burglaries, pawn details, we're turning up the car thieves. So we decided, rather than just have a couple people that were dedicated to auto theft, we decided to make our whole unit specialists. And it is paying off, because we're getting people turning up stolen car investigations that didn't otherwise. So again, expressing support for that focus on auto theft. It's also important to remember that officers, we tend to think of auto theft as being that car or pickup that's sitting out in the driveway. But what makes the training aspect so important is we're not just talking that. We're talking boats, and that has specialized training aspects. We're talking aircraft for the folks who have any type of aircraft involvement in their communities. That can also be a problem. Heavy equipment, construction equipment, tractor trailers, all of that. And it all requires special training, because the crooks are smart. I'll give them credit for that. They learn where the weaknesses are, and they quickly exploit it. And again, pushing for that training is so that the officers can spot that targeted attack before it becomes such a huge problem that we're throwing our hands up not knowing what to do about it. And that's it for me. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen. I just have one of those odd questions that just seems odd, strange to me, that when I look at the stats on this material we just passed out from the Resick Foundation,
it is not the most valuable vehicles that are stolen the most. It tends to be older vehicles of sort of standard kinds of makes, particularly Hondas and Toyotas. Anybody offer up any view of why that is?
Probably all could. There's a number of reasons. One, criminals that are looking to use a vehicle just to further another crime want a low-profile vehicle. They don't want to be driving that flashy Corvette when they go do their bank robbery or their drug deal. They want something that is not going to stand out, so they pick a nondescript older vehicle. The older vehicles are also much more easily capable of being stolen. There's less theft prevention technology. The lock systems are weak, and they're readily available. There's lots of them out there. So your typical car thief that's looking to use that vehicle just to commit other crimes is going to take a relatively low-dollar vehicle to do that, your 1990 Toyota Camry, for example. The more sophisticated organizations will target some of those higher-end vehicles, and those are generally the ones we never see again.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Or Representative Kump, please ask questions.
No questions for the panel, but I just wanted to share with the committee. I recently talked to a young man that has been, he's not on meth right now, but serious meth addict, and he admitted to some of these very crimes we heard about this morning, and he said the most shocking thing they told me was he was high on meth, did not sleep for 17 days once. And I thought, what in the world did you do for 17 24-hour days? He says, well, everything.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more witnesses signed up, and I'll bite them up together, John Powell and Jack Monroe.
17 days.
Sean, Mr. Miller, come up as well. This is 10:45.
Yeah, historical presentation at 10. The floor sessions didn't start until
10:45 is the note I have.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I'm here representing State Farm Insurance Companies. And I might add, I also represent the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. While we have not taken a specific position on this bill, they're very much aware of my aversion to using the insurance system as a tax collection device. House Bill 2898 addresses a serious problem that's occurring everywhere in the country, and auto insurers naturally would support efforts to curb auto theft. This bill, however, does some things that we cannot support. First of all, we believe this bill institutes a tax, and that should be noted on the bill as needing more than a simple majority to pass. Secondly, this bill would invoke a retaliatory tax, which in effect would take almost an equal amount of money that's collected out of the general fund, because those taxes currently go to the general fund. When an insurer is taxed or a fee is applied, they are able then to deduct that from their retaliatory tax in Oregon. So this bill would have a direct general fund impact. The bill attempts to prevent backfilling, that is, having local agencies use this money for current programs. That's found on page 2, lines 32 through 38. However, we do not believe there's an enforcement mechanism for that, so that in essence, this money could be given to an agency and their governing body simply could use the money they were previously putting in to the program for something else. And finally, I'd note that the tax in this case is 50 cents per vehicle semi-annually, so it's a dollar. And in the case of State Farm, it would be roughly $522,000 a year. And the total tax to the state of Oregon would be, I think, larger than $2 million. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from other people in the panel?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, here representing the American Insurance Association. And before I comment, John was too modest to answer the question that Representative Comp posed just a minute ago. His response in the back of the room was that was a lobbyist who was working sleepless for 17 days. There's not a lot to add probably to John's comments. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a serious problem. Those of you that, well, you've all been here, so at least some of you probably saw the multi-part series in the Statesman Journal within the last month on auto theft-related problems. There's certainly no doubt that it's viewed by the insurance industry as a serious problem, and there was reference to bait cars and whatnot that have been provided by the industry to help in this effort. And certainly the dedication of the people that you've heard from is without question. As really was indicated, John, I think, cuts to the chase of the issue. The way this thing is structured, and given Oregon's retaliatory tax law, 731-854, this is a direct hit on the general fund. And so that raises some of the other questions, I think, that have been already raised by members of the committee in terms of how tight this bill might be, either in terms of structuring the various committees or structuring the expenditure of the grant money that's offered up. And so our real problem, however, is the whole question of how it's financed here and the role that we end up being forced to play in fundraising, if you will. So with that, I'll conclude.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association. PCI has over 200 member insurance companies doing business in the state of Oregon. And here today in opposition to House Bill 2898, and our opposition is, as the other panel had indicated, is not with the Motor Vehicle Theft Prevention Board or the advisory committee. It's simply with the surcharge and that dedicated tax on our policyholders. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I won't add anything other than what John had indicated in our opposition, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
I'd like to put to you the question that Representative Cameron was putting to an earlier panel, and maybe see if you had data on that, which is number of registered vehicles in Oregon and the number of them that have comprehensive insurance coverage.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I believe the number is close to 3.25 million total vehicles. And of those, I was trying to do some scratching work. I could not tell you how many of those have comprehensive versus other coverages. It is interesting to note, however, that the data that you questioned, Mr. Chairman, about the older vehicles being stolen, those are the ones who tend not to have comprehensive insurance on them. As opposed to new cars. So that is another problem, I think, with the funding mechanism that's in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, if I may add to that, I think it's hard to tell. Each company by company will have different percentages of comprehensive versus liability coverage. I know some companies may have like a 50-50 split between their coverage. Some, like State Farm, has a higher percentage of comprehensive versus liability. So I'd have to gather that data from different companies for the committee.
It would be helpful to know that, though, you know, within a reasonable tolerance of what, you know, what percentage of all the registered vehicles would be subject to this fee. Representative Krieger.
We're talking about the cost, Mr. Chair, which also we all are concerned about that.
Do you have any way of measuring that when you reduce those number of thefts, how much direct savings there is to the insurance companies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, we did, State Farm did an estimate that the to break even, there would have to be about 11.5% decrease in stolen vehicles in a situation like that. That's the only data I can respond to that question with.
Go ahead.
It would appear where they've had this in effect in Eugene, Portland, they achieved that and more. So there's, you know,
Mr. Chairman,
oftentimes for me, if I'm asked to pay a dollar and I'm going to save two, I'm willing to invest the dollar. And we need to understand the impact, how many cars, and what it really means. I don't think we've got all that information here today.
Absolutely.
Just a real quick question. Would any of the insurance companies you represent be opposed if we collected this fee on every car in the state of Oregon through the DMV registration process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I don't believe that's possible under the constitutional limitation on taxing an automobile or the use of an automobile. All monies generated in that manner must accrue to the highway fund for the construction of roadways. So, there is, in fact, a case on whether a fee is a tax or not of AAA versus somebody, and I'll get your staff that case reference, where there was an attempt to put a fee on registration to pay for underground storage tanks with the concept that every car gets fuel from underground storage tax. Now, this case dealt with whether or not that was a tax, because it was in the bill, it said it was a fee, but the court held that indeed it was a tax. And so having done quite a bit of work on a proposal to tax automobiles to pay for state troopers, again, we find that constitutional measure, again, prohibits a tax on an automobile or the use of an automobile without it accruing to the highway fund.
Senator Cameron.
Just to follow up, if I may, but if it wasn't constitutionally prohibited, would you object to the fee being collected that way to help reduce thefts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, we would not object to that sort of a fee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I know in other states where this is being considered, they are looking at other funding mechanisms, such as surcharges on traffic infractions or other kinds of funding mechanisms, and we would support that as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. When I sponsored this bill, the request of the people, and there was insurance people on that committee that asked us for this to come forward, and I'm sorry that you guys weren't there ahead of time. And originally, they wanted to do a charge on every automobile and ran into the constitutional issue. So then they said, well, no, this was a step back. And they, you know, kind of viewed it as a pass-through that you would actually collect. And I understand the concerns of the insurance industry that if we do this today, what are we going to do? What am I going to come back with tomorrow and the next day and the next day? So, but the aim of this was to reduce auto theft in Oregon and, you know, hopefully not only save the insurance people money, but your customers, which I know you want to protect from the, just like my daughter's car that was stolen, a guy tried to steal parts out of it. He lived in it for a couple of days. It reeked, and yeah. He just, you know. Fortunately, his friends found out that her husband was a cop, and so they hospitalized him because they were afraid he would bring down heat upon them. Other than that, the guy didn't suffer much punishment. But anyway, I don't know. Do you have any suggestions how we might be able to save this proposal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker. We would prefer a more modest sum, creating some pilot projects out of the general fund, since this is going to have a general fund impact anyway. We would think that the bill should be narrowed to a general fund funding, and perhaps set up some pilot projects that would be able to demonstrate the effectiveness. You do have to realize that This bill is, in my opinion, no, this is not for State Farm, a little overly bureaucratic, with committees on a committee and with up to 10% of the proceeds being able to be used for administration. But you can tell by the testimony that's been given that it would be, I think, very difficult to prevent backfilling with these funds, one. And I think the bill would have to be very specific to who would get the money and what its use would be for. And there was another issue I was going to raise, and I can't recall it right now.
That happens to me, too. Yeah. It gets worse, I believe.
Okay. Any further questions?
A quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. I wanted to follow up on the question I asked earlier about the technology and like LoJack or anything like that, because if it looks like the older cars are more likely to be stolen because they don't have that type of technology, are you aware of developments or reductions in insurance rates for cars that have those that technology? I'm just kind of looking ahead at prevention in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I do believe insurers give a discount in some cases for technology that prevents theft. I'll have to check and get back to you with exactly what State Farm does in that regard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I know my insurer does give a discount on different theft prevention devices that are on my vehicles that were put on by the manufacturer. And so I think there are several companies. I don't know about all companies, but I know companies do give discounts for those for that technology.
There are no further questions, then I'll excuse these witnesses. It appears as though there needs to be more work done with this proposal, but there's a purpose here, which is to try to reduce the impact of what may be perceived as a nuisance crime, but it's a pretty serious nuisance crime for Oregonians. And if there's a way we can try to get something that's scaled down that would address that problem, I think that's well worth doing. So I hope that we see an effort to do that. Representative Wisner.
Thank you for those comments, Mr. Chair. And I think all the committee probably agrees, but I think one of the comments that I read over this is Mr. Powell brought up is the bureaucracy. A board under a committee and, you know, executive director, and he can appoint people. I mean, the thing we want to do here is help the law enforcement people, and, I mean, the task force sound like that was what was successful. And I'm not sure putting six legislators out there is going to really help. I think the thing is we need police officers with expertise out there to address this problem. And I would I'm very uncomfortable with the bill. You know, we can talk about, you know, how we attack the problem, but to set up, you know, committee, the committee's under the board, and they're going to meet twice a year and solve this problem. I just have a really difficult time with this proposal.
It is important that the funds that we spend that are drawn from Oregonians and Oregon organizations and companies that are providing service to Oregonians, that those dollars be spent in ways that we can tangibly measure our improving the lives of Oregonians. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2898. And as I indicated earlier on, we'll not be proceeding to work session on the next three bills that are listed, 2303, 2339, and 2125. We'll be carrying over 2125 until tomorrow in hopes that the amendments will be ready on that bill. But I will open a work session on Senate Bill 270. Council Kalmanson, if you could remind us what's happening in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 270 was heard by this committee on March 6th. It allows an operator of a, quote, assistive communication device for a juror with a disability to be present during jury deliberations. There were some concerns about confidentiality that were raised by Representative Flores and I think a few other members, and I believe that there's been some research done and those concerns have been allayed. But if not, I'm sure we'll hear so right now. I think the oath for interpreters has been updated to give greater protection to ensure confidentiality. I think that can be described more fully. There's some people in the audience who could describe that.
And counsel, is the oath that's administered to interpreters, that is people who are doing language interpretation, is that same oath taken by a person who's providing assistive communication devices?
Yes, and I think that's they were expressly put into the oath. Is that correct? Yes, I'm seeing a nod. And they weren't before, and now they are. So that would ensure that they are required to keep deliberations confidential.
Okay, committee. Representative Krieger.
Representative Cameron, I talked about this. Is it specific to the obligation of the interpreter or the operator after the trial where they would have inside information as to who said what and they could be used like in a book deal or a movie deal?
I don't believe there's anything in Senate Bill 270 that deals with that. I think that is part of this oath that they'll keep confidential anything that they hear within the jury room. But there's definitely nothing in Senate Bill 270 that specifically deals with that issue.
Mr. Chair, but it only deals with, it extends beyond after the end of the trial, in other words, not only during the trial until a sentencing or decision has been made, but after that's been done. From that point forward, do they still have that obligation, and would it preclude them from making a movie? Or because they would actually have information from the deliberations in the courtroom as to who said what, that might be very valuable for someone that wanted to do that sort of business.
Mr. Chair, so would any juror. And if it's not prohibited for a juror, I'm just trying to figure out what...
I didn't want someone who was a hired person to come in there and make a profit out of it,
I can read to you what the oath says. If I am appointed as an interpreter or an assistive communications device operator for a juror, I also swear or affirm that I will not participate personally in the jury's deliberations, nor make any comment about my personal recollections of the evidence or my opinions about the outcome of this case. I will not disclose, retain, or comment upon anything that I hear in jury deliberations unless ordered to do so by the court. I promise this under the pains and penalties of perjury. So there's nothing in here that limits this only to the time period during deliberations, and I would read this as applying to afterwards as well.
You said something about during jury deliberations.
It's right here.
Okay, and what about beyond that?
They're not going to retain or comment about anything that they hear in jury deliberations, but it's not limited.
Okay. Yeah, it would appear to me, committee, that we would be restricting what could be disclosed by the interpreters and operators of assistive communication devices to a far greater extent than we restrict jurors, which may or may not be the right choice, but at least it means that this bill would not be expanding the dissemination of information about what happened.
Mr. Chair, after having visited with Ms. Cosine and having discussion, my concerns were laid, and that is that anyone that was assisting with assistive communication devices be held to the same standard of confidentiality during the pendency of a proceeding. And with this oath modification and with the assurance that this was going to be an effort that was made for judges to underscore that with the jury as well as those who were in assistive positions, I'm satisfied that the intent is met. And then I think as you read it, it strikes me as that they do have a little bit more of an ongoing duty after the trial. So I think that they would be covered. And whether that was intended or not, it sounds like they would have to be tightening of their lip and not being able to reveal information that came forward in a trial.
That's how I read it as well. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, and I'm glad Representative Flores. I think from what the oath that was read there, the intent of the oath is to, from my concern, the intent of the oath would limit them from going out and doing what Representative Krieger and I were thinking about. Going out, and I can talk about what happened back there and sell a book or a movie or whatever at the expense of the other jurors or whatever that happened there. So I'm fine with that, based on how the oath is read.
Do I hear a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 270 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Doesn't it have referral to Ways and Means?
Is there something?
Is there?
I don't know. Nope.
Financial, adult financial.
Representative Cameron moves the Senate Bill 270.
I'm with the wrong one. That's the wrong bill.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we have no expenditure impact. Here is the verdict on the impact of this bill. Is there any with a due pass recommendation? Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger. Aye.
Representative Reese.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Winston.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 270 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, since you made the motion on that, would you be willing to carry?
Sure, be happy to.
Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 270. That concludes our agenda for today, committee. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.